Hello and welcome to the third of the oneliner.com special Edinburgh International Film Festival podcasts. I'm Drew Tavendale and joining me tonight is Scott Morris.
Hello.
And we'll just get straight into it by talking about a film about Kim Jong-il. Scott, would you like to tell us something about that?
North Korea. As Bill Bailey would describe it, the keyboard player in the Axis of Evil. It's very difficult to take the nation seriously as a threat to anyone's security, let alone the entire world. I suppose for a nation with at least nuclear ambitions, if not nuclear capability, and a massive, although ill-equipped army, we shouldn't be quite so glib about them. But Kim Jong-il, though, look at him, the daft little blighter. If ever there was a national leader more susceptible to Nelson Muntz-style pointing and laughing, then he haven't been alive at the same time that as I have. Being rude and snarky about North Korea is rather like shooting a barrel falling off a log, or something else that happens to be quite easy. This American-backed film, The Shushe Idea, I believe that's how it's pronounced, takes a slightly more high-concept point by combining existing documentary footage of North Korean parades and so forth, glorifying the dear little leader, also combining North Korean-backed films, themselves a fairly laughable experience, and some original mockumentary-style footage of a South Korean filmmaker working by choice in a North Korean artist's commune. This is not, in theory, a terrible idea, and I've heard much worse in the cold, harsh, unforgiving glare of reality that it doesn't really work in practice. When the concept of a film feels like it's rather stretched, despite only running to a slender 68 minutes, there's trouble brewing at Tamil. There are a few laughs to be had, admittedly, although most of them feel rather cheap and tawdry. There's only so much mileage to be had out of Russians speaking English in a brah, the stilted accent. Well, okay, there's practically an infinite amount of mileage to be had out of that, but I'm not going to pretend that it's massively highbrow entertainment. The point of the film, if we can call it that for a minute, seems to be an examination of Kim Jong-il's Shushe tracks, waffling on and on about self-sufficiency and how revolutionary art should challenge capitalist ideals and essentially toe the Communist Party line in ways that chief whips would love to be able to make Houses of Parliament emulate. As points go, it's gently made to the point of being more or less unnoticeable. However, I don't want to sound too harsh about this film. It is, after all, at least mildly diverting, and given the number of actively offensive or extraordinarily disinteresting films that have sat through this festival, this actually puts it quite high up the rankings. It's decent in a sort of mediocre, keep-watching-if-you-stumble-across-it-well-channel-hopping kind of way. However, there's not enough here to warrant expending any effort in seeing it.
It's endless fun to be had making fun of Kim Jong-il, but as with so many things, he's really a parody of himself. When you came out of that screening, you mentioned that you actually thought Team America World Police had probably done a better job of ripping the piss out of the North Korean leader. Still think that's correct?
Yeah, definitely. So it's certainly a far funnier film.
Matt Damon!
But yeah, it has the advantage of taking the piss out of Matt Damon and Michael Moore as well. Again, it's okay, but certainly not worth taking any heroic efforts to find.
So when it inevitably pops up on the History Channel or BBC4 and you're in looking for something to watch, it might be worth sitting down for, but other than that, don't bother seeking it out.
Other than that, I'd give it a body swerve. Okay, next up, Drew, why don't you tell us about Trail of the Screaming Forehead?
Well, I can see no reason why not, so I will. Longhead Bay guest house proprietor Amos goes into the woods one evening to investigate the source of an odd noise, and it turns out that a meteorite has hit the earth, as they often do, but this one's carrying with it the strangest of passengers, one of the last members of an alien race who, after the planet was laid waste by nuclear war, have evolved into ambulant talking foreheads. Because that sort of thing can happen.
Yeah, I've read about that. It can happen.
Damn you, Oppenheimer. So they need host bodies in order to survive and reproduce, so they've come to Earth to breed. The alien forehead attaches itself to Amos's bonds and rides them on into town to spread to the other humans. Meanwhile, at the Institute for Brain Studying, specifically the Department for Thinking and Thought Study, Dr. Sheila Baxter is undertaking groundbreaking research into where our thoughts really come from. Eschewing the accepted theory of brain-centric thinculating, she claims to have found evidence that the forehead rather than the brain is the source of human intellect, and is even isolating a chemical compound which she's dubbed forehedazine that she believes is linked to intelligence. She scoffed at, unsurprisingly, by the rest of the Institute's faculty, which she seduces her fellow academic, Dr. Philip Latham, and persuades him to become her guinea pig. She extracts forehedazine from donor foreheads, don't ask, and injecting it into Dr. Latham in an attempt to increase his intellect. You may well ask where exactly Dr. Baxter could come by such a thing as donor foreheads. Despite the fact I told you not to ask, I'll answer that question for you. It's handled by the simple expedient of buying some from a bloke down the pub. That most universal of sources for dodgy, moody goods.
It's not from a guy in a dodgy Mac who like, opens his coats and there's lots of foreheads hanging on it.
No, but it's probably not far off. He did have a hat. And a moustache, a dodgy moustache.
You want foreheads? Dude, I can get you foreheads.
There are ways. I can get you a forehead by 3 o'clock this afternoon. You don't want to know. As Dr. Latham's intellect increases, so does the size of his forehead, and the alien possessed take him for one of their own. However, being a non-possessed human, he doesn't wish to see the human race turned into zombies, although some would argue that large sections of the population already are. That's a discussion for another day. He turns his supposedly formidable brain to fighting them, and as the number of inhabitants of the town possessed by the parasitic foreheads increases, their presence is finally noted by town librarian Millie and two sailors on shore leave, Big Dan Freighter and Dutch the Swede Anacrombie.
That's an awesome name.
It is, isn't it? After a spot of research in the local library's forehead section, no, really, but don't worry, it is meant to be that silly, the trio confront the alien bobbleheads in a final showdown. Now, I've spent quite a long time telling you the plot, and that might suggest that there's something of substance there, but unfortunately it's not really the case. This is a parody of 1950s B-movies, most notably The Blob, and director Larry Blamire certainly has the look down pat. Longhead Bay is dressed in suitably garish and overcooked colours, and the actor's makeup applied with an industrial-sized trowel. The stop-motion effects of the sentient foreheads are also right on the mark. This film even comes presented by animation legend Ray Harryhausen, whose own films are amongst those parodied. And the film starts off promisingly enough. The awful and often ludicrous dialogue of the film's inspirations is sharply observed, and the stilted, almost painfully bad delivery, and we're talking almost Shatner bad here, by the actors is very, very well judged. What the film, though, like the forehead creatures within it, lacks is legs. While there are some genuinely funny moments, after about half an hour, the film just runs out of ideas, and the final hour is pretty much the same material over again. It doesn't take long for the film to become tedious and wearing, but rather than being irritating, it's just disappointing given how well it began. And I don't want to be too harsh here on the director's cast, as there's certainly something of merit in there. There's just not enough of it. And I can't help feeling that if this had been a 30-minute piece, perhaps made for TV rather than the cinema, then it would have been considerably more successful. Firstly, what the biggest problem is that the films that the trailer of The Screaming Forehead sends up are, well, by today's standards at least, parodies of themselves. Not least of these is the most infamous of the genre, Ed Wood's Plan 9 from Outer Space, widely regarded as one of the worst films of all time, and far, far funnier, albeit unintentionally, than any number of spoofs. If you're a fan of this sort of film, it might be something worth looking out for, perhaps as a DVD rental on TV rather than paying to go to the cinema to see it. But it's reasonable in that it starts off quite funny, it's just not got the stamina to last to the end.
But when you were, what you were saying there, it sounded like a perfect Saturday evening DVD rental with a crate of beer next to you and a few mates around to laugh at it.
Yeah, I'd go for that. The problem is just that there's so much of it, it's a retread of the funny stuff at the beginning, and it gets tiresome. But when might be a good time to watch it is if you've got some friends around after quite a lot of beer, quite late at night, when you've got a good chance of not concentrating for the full thing or possibly even staying awake. But you'll be awake for the first half hour and suitably beered up and will really enjoy that and perhaps forget the rest.
Mm-hmm. For some reason, when you were going through it, I was getting flashbacks to Peter Jackson's Bad Taste. Is it something vaguely similar in tone to that, or is it much worse?
I don't think I've actually seen Bad Taste, which I feel dirty for saying, but I don't think I have. I think it's one of those films I've always meant to get around to watching but never actually did.
You are missing out. I'd say go. Yeah, that's my recommendation. Go see Bad Taste instead of this, despite the fact that I've not actually seen this either. But
okay, on the first Sunday morning of this year's film festival, having split up for the first film, we joined forces to watch Argentinian film The Third Pint, And Scott is going to tell you why this was a bad, bad plan.
Right, let me ask you a question. Not you, Drew. Mr. Listener, or Mr. or Mrs. Listener. As it's just about the only factor that determines whether or not you're going to get even the slightest amount of pleasure from this here film. Are you the sort of person who wouldn't mind watching some stranger's grainy, roundly uninteresting holiday videos? Because, on balance, that's pretty much all that the third pint reduces itself to. The setup runs thusly. Some guy named David Mates, played by Ramiro Ramos, drinks a pint of beer, went out on a date, and he finds that he's turned himself invisible. Throwing for something of a loop by this turn of events, he decides to withdraw from normal society and make a study of people, then eventually travelling around the world while relating to an audience his unique brand of deeply insightful psychology, for given values of deep insight and psychology. For someone who boasts throughout the film that his unique condition allowed him to see more of the human condition, it's surprising how trite and inconsequential his musings turn out to be. His most profound observation appears to be that sometimes when children fall over, they don't cry. Thanks, Sherlock. Similarly, deeply unoriginal hippie-ish codswallop is doled out over the course of the piece, with such startling advice as don't be slaves to corporate culture, and don't run through life when you could walk, and see the beauty in everything, man, groovy, far out, etc. Now, this may have worked through a haze of hashish in the 60s, but it is helpful advice for today's work. It's encroaching onto chocolate fire car territory. It's especially rich coming from someone who can freeload his way through life stealing food and travelling for free because he's fucking invisible. But I have to work to eat, thanks so very much. Now, disagreeing with a central character's philosophy does not automatically make it a bad film. What automatically makes it a bad film, at least around these parts at least, is to be so very, very, very boring. And lo and behold, the third pint is very, very, very boring. Saying nothing of any worth on any philosophical basis, visually having both the bland artistic sense and barren unmemorability of amateur holiday footage the world over, and a crushing, gratingly repetitive soundtrack that makes even Philip Glass scores seem bearable, there's nothing of any worth on any level at all in this film. Very film festival. The third pint can do one. Writer-director Luciano Podkaminski can do one. The annoyingly accented, stilted, unlikable performance from Ramiro Ramos can do one. The only thing that stops this being worse than Crack Willow is that it's merely coma-inducingly boring rather than offensive and coma-inducingly boring. Once again, this is another selection from this year's Edinburgh Film Festival Under the Radar selection that I really, really wish stayed under the radar.
Yes, the Under the Radar section, despite their claims that this is being talked about around the world as a big success, is pants, as is this film. And it's 70 minutes long. It's about 71 minutes too long in running time. And I'd like my time back, please.
Or at the very least, I would have appreciated my time of 70 minutes in front of this film to feel like 70 minutes in front of this film rather than 12 hours.
There's the thing, too. I was fed up with it within about 3 minutes, and it never won me back, unsurprisingly. It's just, it's dull, it's pointless, it's trite, the character's an idiot. Let's spend no more time discussing this travesty of film.
Next up, Drew takes us to Ireland with Eden, a lovely film from the old country, arre, arre, arre. Potato, potato, potato. Why don't you tell us about that film there, Drew?
I will tell you about this film. There's no big story, no complicated or compelling plot in this relationship drama from director Declan Rex. Rather, it's a simple tale of two people unable to be honest with each other and themselves about their relationship. It's set in a small town in Ireland, but really it could be anywhere. I mean, it's so universal, the characters and their situation. Breda, played by the Magdalene sisters Eileen Walsh, and Billy, played by Aidan Kelly, are married, but now it's in name only. Each is too cowardly to tell the other how they feel. Billy no longer finds himself attracted to his wife and feels trapped in his role as husband and father, while Breda yearns for the physical and emotional relationship she so badly needs to feel content. While Breda looks after the children, Billy seeks to recapture his carefree bachelor days and spends most nights out drinking with friends. He regales those who will listen with tales of long ago derring do, and lusts after the beautiful younger women he meets in the town's bars. On the 10th wedding anniversary, Breda makes a special effort to rekindle things with Billy. Though he's clearly reluctant, Billy joins her on a night out, their first together in a long, long time. Each has far different expectations from the night though, and after things go badly awry, they are finally forced to face up to the truth. So far, so humdrum, you may think, and certainly it's not the most interesting premise for a film I've ever heard, but what makes it worth watching are the engaging, expertly played performances from the leads and the authentic dialogue in Eugene O'Brien's screenplay. It does unfortunately take a little while to get going, and in particular I find Aidan Kelly's Billy difficult to warm to or sympathise with, though as this is a man who escapes to the pub rather than face up to his fatherly responsibilities, sympathy is appropriately undeserved. Fortunately, the second half is far more compelling and certainly rewards your perseverance. It's a simple story. I don't really have much more to say about that other than that the performances are engaging and probably worth a look.
No, you're not selling that to me. Sounds ten a penny. Why is this good? Let's role play. Let's imagine you are the salesman trying to put this towards a distribution deal. Come on, what's this unique selling point? What's going to draw me in? What's the hook, man?
You've got me.
God, you're fired.
I hate a salesman anyway.
You're not in charge of my my sales efforts from now on.
Good, I'd end up hating myself. I hate a salesman. They're always so pushy.
So this falls into the worthy drama category.
Yeah, that would be a fair thing to say. There's very little story. It really is just a character piece. And I said all that it's really appropriate to say about it, because there's not much more to say other than, that's it.
You can't say something like a white knuckle thrill ride, 5 stars, says Paul Ross. No.
Well, I could.
Is that not appropriate?
Well, I could, but I'd be lying. I prefer to try and get honest opinions across.
So basically, if you're in the mood for a more or less unremarkable, worthy drama rather than anything with that's any interest in it, then that's the kind of time you should watch Eden. We'll put it firmly into the B-list category, I think. Okay, so we'll move on from Eden with Dreams with Sharp Teeth. Well, I could simply say that this is a documentary on sci-fi author Harold Ellison and have effectively summed up the film. It does somewhat fail to convey how funny and entertaining this look at the mighty character that Ellison Cutts actually is. He has as much right to be described as a science fiction luminary as anyone else who's ever walked the face of this planet. Listing his awards, achievements and canon of work would fill up minutes in this audio production, but would be something of a lengthy exercise in redundancy. Dreams with Sharp Teeth is a documentary look at his long career, and more at the attitudes that drive him, less than the career, actually. Boy, what an attitude it is. Eschewing the stereotype of authors as mawkish folks peeping over the end of a typewriter, Harlan's simple refusal to take even the merest hint of shit from anyone leads to a character that's upset just as many people as it's delighted. With much of Ellison's stories coming from his friends, including contemporaries such as Neil Gaiman and Robin Williams, it is a highly enjoyable look at a highly colourful character. It's not, however, a warts-and-all exposé of his personality and his actions. While the filmmakers could not hope to skirt around the man's legendary temper and, well, rantings, they have contrived to present them in as cuddly, fun-filled and lovable fashion as a 72-year-old crossing a road calling everyone a motherfucker as is possible. Most of the time when Ellison breaks his vitriol cannon out of storage and unloads on someone, I can agree with him. Every now and again I don't, and at that point it becomes very obvious to me why so many would think of him as a complete asshole. If Harlan has no respect for someone, he's not afraid to show that. His argument tends to be based on the simple comparative achievements of whoever he's picking a fight with, and more often than not, Harlan does happen to be a man better placed to have better answers and should be taken notice of more than whoever happens to be questioning him at the time. It does seem at points as though he's a beat off saying, "Don't you know who I am?" And it's exactly that sort of behaviour that makes him so controversial. But it's also what makes Harlan Ellison Harlan Ellison, so complaining about it is probably a self-defeating proposition. If you like the man and his works, this is a deeply funny and heartfelt retrospective come character study. If you don't like the man, then, well, it's pretty damn funny anyway, although it's probably not going to change your mind of anyone who's already previously formed an opinion of him. As a film based entirely on the eloquence of its subject, there's really no way that this could go wrong, and indeed it doesn't. Dreams with Sharp Teeth is as entertaining a biography as I've seen, and watching Ellison clamber onto his soapbox and dispense pints of frothy, foaming anger on, well, damn near the entire world is simply a joy to behold. Highly recommended, especially if, like me, you are a colossal geek.
Yeah, see, I didn't really know anything about Harlan Ellison other than being familiar with some of his work and some of his telly plays for the likes of Babylon 5. So I went in there not really knowing what to expect from him at all, and came out pretty much thinking that he was my hero. Because apart from a few things, I agreed with an awful lot of his rants, and it's quite amusing to see somebody who gets angrier about the world than I do, and who also, like me, does not suffer fools gladly. Although the difference being that angry as I get, my hardwired courtesy just saying, politeness circuits tend to kick in most times. I don't just let off a stream of expletive-ridden vitriol on people's faces just because they happen to look at me funny. No, not anymore, not since the police stepped in. I mean, I found it very entertaining, and he's certainly a very engaging character. The only problem I had with the film is that it's very, very unbalanced. There was nobody to come along and say, actually, I think this man's a complete idiot. Here is why. I mean, even if that was, again, something to rebut that. But it doesn't stop it being entertaining. It just stops it being a piece of journalism rather than just an exposé of the writer.
Yeah, it's almost a love letter rather than an exposé. It's very, very reverential towards him. And there's nothing wrong with that as a sort of... It's almost like an elegy for someone who's not dead yet, but it's definitely very entertaining. It's certainly one of the most entertaining films I've seen this festival, and it's highly recommended for
me. Yeah, me too. I was saying, I really enjoyed it. It's just that it might be nice to see somebody saying, oh, I don't like him, I think he's wrong, and this is why.
Okay, so that's highly recommended. Let's see if The Wave is equally good. Drew?
Okay, The Wave is a German film. It's based on the results of a genuine experiment carried out by a teacher in 1967 to demonstrate to his charges the effects of mass hysteria. This updating of Morten Wu's novel of the same name tells the tale of Rainer Wenger, played by Jürgen Vogel, a teacher in a contemporary German high school who takes a class in autocracy as part of the school's project week, German schools being completely different from Scottish ones apparently. Certainly never did anything like that. After talking about what defines an autocracy, the class are asked to give an example of one, and a collective groan is let out when the Third Reich is inevitably mentioned. Sick of hearing about fascism and the Nazis, a constant topic in the curriculum of German schools, the students suggest that they no longer need to hear about it as Germany has moved on and a dictatorship is no longer possible in their country. This gives Wenger an idea for a practical experiment of the class to teach them how an autocracy works. Suggesting that they turn their class into a totalitarian state for the week, Wenger's elected leader and begins to instruct his class in discipline. The students adopt a uniform, a name, the Wave, and even a salute. Sounding familiar? Unfortunately, the experiment works far too well and soon spills out of the classroom into the rest of the school and the local community. Beginning with vandalism, members of the Wave are also caught up in conflict with a local anarchist gang. Germany's very, very different. We don't have local anarchist gangs round here.
Purely being in a gang defeats the point of being an anarchist. You can't impose a structure on anarchy.
Again, also another discussion for another day. Let's stick with autocracy for now. Yeah. While Wave members are protected from bullies and gangs by the strength of their group, non-members are in turn bullied and ostracised. One weird kid, so lonely that he buys cannabis to give to the cool kids in his class for free, just so they can refer to them as his homies, is particularly enamoured by this new movement. From the wild gleam in his eye, you know that this is the kid who will take it all too far and not let go. Trying too hard, but he's not quite hip, teacher Wenger, who wears punk t-shirts and allows his students to call him Rainer rather than Mr. Wenger, revels in the adulation and success of his experiment and refutes the claims of students and other teachers that it's gone too far. He considers it rather that it's sour grapes on the other faculty members' part, having never considered him legit as he went to community college instead of university. But after a violent encounter with an inter-school water polo march, and it would no doubt amuse Stephen Colbert, that this school also subscribes to his belief of the true meaning of the Olympic Games, i.e. pretend to care about water polo, and an almost fatal assault by a member of the Wave and a visiting player, Wenger is finally woken up to the dangers posed by the movement and tries to stop it, if only it were that simple. Unlike anything I can think of, the only thing I remember fondly being the daily lunchtime card games, this film actually made me want to be back at school, not to be in part of this class, I hasten to add. But I wanted to stop the film every 15 minutes to have a discussion. It felt very much like it would work well as an educational piece that a teacher would put on and then stop so the class could discuss it. And of course it wouldn't have to be school to discuss it, but I almost wanted to call it to the projection and stop here, we must debate this, the rights and wrongs and merits of the movement and the ideals behind it. It's a deeply thought-provoking film, and the resonances are particularly poignant in Germany. But the interesting fact that the original experiment on which the film was based took place not in Germany at all, but in California, leave you wondering quite how easily such a movement could take hold in any other country. But almost to a person, the performances of the high school students in the film is excellent, and the charismatic Jürgen Vogel makes a very believable leader of the movement, as well as a teacher that you can believe the students would get behind. The only problems with the film are the wild-eyed character alluded to earlier seemed a bit too obvious, but without knowing enough about the initial genuine experiment and trying to find people to talk about it other than the teacher who created it is almost impossible. It's hard to know whether that's actually real or not. And the classes experiment is missing political ideals as a motive for their movement. Other than that, it's a deeply thought-provoking film and highly recommended.
Yeah, it sounds awfully interesting. Probably it would have been a far better choice than my alternative. Well, while Drew was off enjoying himself at a decent film, I was watching Left Bank, which is a Belgian film. Belgium, chocolates, Tintin and Poirot. As the old jokes would go, I'd rather hope that this Belgian film would provide the nation with something else to crow about and wave around in the face of smug racist goons like myself who keep mentioning old jokes about chocolates, Tintin and Poirot as being only good things to come from Belgium. Sadly, it's pish. I might have expected that, as it is, after all, starting from the disadvantage of being a horror film. Marie, played by Aileen Coopens, is an ambitious, driven young track runner who looks to be on track for success at the European Championships before she collapses of exhaustion and is ordered to take a month off from the rigours of training. She's upset by this, but finds some solace in the arms of her recently acquired archer boyfriend, Bobby, the two having recently embarked on a passionate affair. Marie moves out of her mother's house and in with Bobby, who lives on the left bank of Antwerp's River Scheldt in a somewhat tired, ugly-looking 70s tower block. Now, this left bank of the river appears to have garnered something of a bad reputation in years past, being used as a dumping ground for the city's more undesirable elements like witches and plague victims. With the witches and plague victim demographic being somewhat lessened by Times March, real estate developers moved in to reclaim the area, despite the superstitions and folk myths that have sprung up over time. To cut what is a not particularly long, but certainly not particularly interesting story short, there's a big pit of evil in the basement of the tower block and bad things happen to Marie. There are certainly far more layers to this film, such as the investigation into the mysterious disappearance of the previous occupant of Bobby's flat, but in the end they're little more than a smokescreen to distract from the fact that despite playing the broody psychological thriller card at the start, by the end this film boils down to the big pit of evil playing silly buggers. It's something of a pity, because before it starts waving its supernatural willy in the wind, there are some decent filmmaking on show. Directing his debut feature, Pieter Van Hees does manage to make shots of the wooded areas around look pretty creepy, and the performances from Aileen Coopens is certainly well above the average for this sort of thing. The pacing is reasonable, at least up until the point it starts to flip from trying to build tension through Bobby's increasingly intense jealous behaviour and moving into some bullshit Wicker Man-esque cultism in the last 20 minutes, which feels like it's been edited in accidentally from a completely different film. Marketed as an original moving thriller, in actuality, it's just another in a seemingly endless line of shitty horror wannabes. While I concede that it's bolted together more robustly and from higher quality materials than most, the inescapable fact that it's just another pretty dull horror that isn't remotely scary and doesn't have the fallback of having any interesting plot to fall back on. Can we please have a moratorium on horror flicks until people work out what makes them scary? Meanwhile, don't bother with this.
Oh no, you're suggesting I went and saw a good film and missed another shitty horror to add to the amount of my life wasted watching shitty horrors? Again, oh no!
Sadly, yes.
Okay, and on that rather disappointing note, we're going to finish this podcast and we'll be off to see some more films to bring your opinions on them very shortly. So, for now, goodbye.
Take it easy.
Good debates. I'm gonna go to the